Hey, Stackers, worried about refinancing those student loans? You've heard us and other shows talk about how important that can be and how you can drive down your interest rates, drive down the money that you pay, the interest you pay to the man. We're going to take a different tact here. The reason we have our sponsors is because they're so good at what they do. We're going to talk about when not to refinance your student loans with Amanda Wood from SoFi, because there are plenty of times when SoFi will tell you not to refinance your student loan. What are those? Well, they're a little bit technical. They don't apply to everybody. But if you're somebody who's thought about refinancing your student loans, join us on Thursday. That's April 20th, this coming Thursday, stackingbenjamins.com/webinar. stackingbenjamins.com/webinar. That'll give you details on how to get there. Also, if you're in our green room, stackingbenjamins.com/green room, we're going to be playing it live for our inner circle friends over in our closed Facebook group. Really excited that we can talk about something that, you know, you've got all these student loan refinance companies out there. Let's talk about the other side of this equation when you maybe shouldn't listen. Then 7 days later, we're going to talk life insurance. What's the right amount? How do you get it? And the people that we trust with that are our friends at Haven Life. I'll have more on that for you next week. But if you're wondering about life insurance myths and breaking through those, our friends at Haven Life are going to be there. So 2 weeks in a row, webinars. We're going to try to get these really cranked up, guys, so that we can give you a lot of help. All right, let's roll on the show.
Hi, this is Kelly from Detroit, Michigan. And when I'm not changing diapers, and no, not mine, I'm stacking Benjamins.
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. Happy Friday, money nerds. I'm podcast engineer extraordinaire Steve Stewart. And because Joe's mom kicked Doug out of the basement again for selling her rock collection on eBay, man, that guy. You're stuck with me in the announcer chair today. But nothing to worry about, because boy, do we have an action-packed show for you today. Please welcome, from Afford Anything, Paula Pant, and the awesome author of Control Your Cash, Greg McFarlane. Finally, here's a guy who loved the roundtable so much, he paid off Len Penzo to come back for a second week, from the Paychecks and Balances podcast, Rich Jones. Then, in our FreshBooks FinTech segment, big news from financial app Digit broke this week. We'll chat with Brad Lawler from The Draft App, Shane Steele from Chime, and Mike Lentz from Tip Yourself about what happens when financial tools pivot and what to do if you use the Digit app. And now here he is, that guy we're surprised every week hasn't been grounded by his mom, Joe Salcihi.
Steve, I've been grounded plenty of times. Hey, everybody. I'm Joe Salcihi, Average Joe Money on Twitter, and it feels like October 1st, 1928, all over again, if you know what I mean, and maybe you don't know what I mean. But we got a great show today, action-packed, timely show. We're going to talk about Digit, and for those of you that don't know, Digit is a financial app that decided to start charging. Their service has been free, and my internet, because I follow a lot of financial stuff, blew up. So we reached out to Ethan Block from Digit, and we haven't heard back from him yet. So we are rolling on a roundtable in today's FreshBook FinTech segment of three other app providers. And, you know, in that business, these are young companies. And what makes a company pivot as hard as Digit did? What's the fallout going to be? We're going to have some insiders, because I've heard a lot from the customer point of view, haven't heard a lot from the other side. So excited about that in the middle, but excited to have Rich Jones coming back again. So that'll be fun. But you know what else is fun? Heading to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi. What you'll find there is they're the leader in marketplace lending, helping you with student loans, personal loans, and mortgages. Here's how it works. Point your browser to stackybenjamins.com/SOFI. It'll ask you which type help you're looking for. And from that point, you fill in a few details about you. And like our friend Dan Macklin over at SoFi says, in a few seconds in most cases, you'll know everything about how they can work with you. You'll be able to pick from different terms, check out the interest rates on variable and fixed rate options, and get that ball rolling. In fact, it's so easy. MagnifyMoney.com lists their fine print rating as A+, meaning it's super easy to understand. You're looking for lower rates and a good partner. They're looking for a new member to help. For your mortgage, your student loans, personal loans, head to stackybenjamins.com/SoFi. They're going to throw in $100 if you use our link for your student loan refinance on your next personal loan. stackybenjamins.com/SoFi. And that place that gave them a fine print rating. How great is this, by the way? A comparison shop that gives you fine print ratings. Like, I don't want a bunch of baloney. We had Michael Asari on from Feebelly. I thought that was a really cool app, but I don't want to have to use Feebelly. And a great way to not have to do that is to head to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money first. When you're picking your checking account, your savings account, your credit cards, your auto loans, whatever it might be, Magnify Money is there. In fact, a Reddit user said that over 92% of the products out there are on Magnify Money, where the second best spot, which we won't name here because they're the evil empire, is stackybenjamins.com/Magnify Money. You know, with interest rates going up, we're starting to see some movement in savings account rates. So if your cash reserve is earning, let's say 0.2, 0.3, lots of better options available online if you had to Magnify Money. I would, at the very least, just go there and take a look, because what's cool is you don't have to register, you don't have to sign in, you can just do it. And I love that. stackybenjamins.com/Magnify Money. All right. We made you money on SoFi. We made you money on Magnify Money. Let's get this party started. All right, let's walk across the basement here and fire up my dad's shortwave. It's amazing. We haven't had this thing serviced in forever, and it still runs just so well. You know, people are using all kinds of technology, and that old stuff is made so well that we get by with this for another week. And on the shortwave, I think, in Las Vegas, Nevada, I believe Paula Pant from Afford Anything is here.
Hey, is your shortwave running? Then you better go catch it.
Do you make those crank calls?
No, I don't think I've ever made a prank call.
Yeah, but
have I? I don't know. I take that back. I mean, certainly I wouldn't have made one like past, say, third or fourth grade. And if I ever did, it certainly wasn't the refrigerator running joke. In fact, it took me many years to understand that joke.
How did you? Of course it did. But the rule of 72 took you 13 seconds, didn't it? Like, oh, I...
And the rule of 25 and the rule of 33. We got all of those. I've nailed them. But this refrigerator running thing, I'm a little confused about that one.
I don't get that. So the one that we did, it's harder now because they have caller ID. But actually, before we get to this, I'm going to explain this, but I got to get somebody else on the line. Greg McFarland from Control Your Cash. You out there?
Yeah, I'm exhausted. I've been up to a lot since our last podcast. Haven't talked to Paula and you, and I... shouldn't mention the other guy until you announce him. And what's it been, a week? How you guys doing?
It has been forever. I so missed you. But did you make crank? Because you and I grew up at a time when you could actually make crank calls because they couldn't just star 69, see who the heck it was.
Yeah, star 69 and star 67 made their debut when I was in college. But I never did that. That was one little piece of childhood that just passed me by. I'm not saying I'm better than the people who did. I just never had an interest.
This is when we missed Len Penzo, because you know that Len did. You know Len made crank calls. But the one that we did, Paula, I would call up a guy and I'd say, is Mr. Williams there? And he'd say, no, I think you have the wrong number, and hang up. And then we'd wait a couple minutes and I'd call back and I'd say, is Mr. Williams there? You go, no, it's the same number. You're dialing the wrong number. And, oh, I'm sorry. Hang up again. Call up again a few minutes later. Is Mr. Williams there? Stop calling me. Are you kidding me? You're dialing the wrong number. All right, buddy. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm sorry. Then you wait like 15, 20 minutes and you call back again and change your voice. You go, yeah, this is Mr. Williams. Has there been any messages for me? Then you laugh. Then you laugh your head off because it's the dumbest joke ever.
I don't think Len could have done that, because back when he was a kid, didn't he have to go through an operator? Hey, give me Klondike 52387.
That's
Right. And then you got a witness.
Right. Either that or it was just this Morse code. Right. And they had to do that. All right. And joining us for the second week in a row, I'm so happy he came back. The property values are up. He lives in a place where property values are sky high anyway, from the Bay Area. And half of the team of Paychecks and Balances, Rich Jones is back for more. You are a sucker, man.
Hey, I enjoyed the first round. Happy to come back. And I do want to point out that I do not own in the Bay Area. I do not own, and I have no plan to, because it's insane out here. Interestingly, on the prank call front, I never got into prank calls, but when I was five, because I used to have this obsession with garbage trucks. I guess every kid has their thing that they're obsessed with. I called a garbage truck company and said I wanted to order the largest dumpster that they had, and they delivered it to the house.
Oh, what happened to your house that day?
Yeah, it was not a good day in the House of Jones. I'll put it that way.
How deep was your voice when you were 5 years old?
Well, and that's the whole thing. To this day, I cannot figure out, unless they were drunk or under the influence of something else, why they would listen to a five-year-old kid who's ordering a dumpster and can't tell you anything about the dimensions, but says they want the largest one you have. And I'm talking one of those construction site, rectangular, super long, could be at a port where ships are bringing in those big crates and all of that stuff. They delivered something that size to a house off of the words of a five-year-old kid. They didn't take a deposit or anything. Well, I guess they probably couldn't have taken a deposit then, because technology wasn't the way it is today. But I have not been able to figure that out to this day, why they delivered that damn dumpster.
I'm glad you're now using your communication powers for good.
Yeah. Greg, there's no way that shocks you when you look at how amazing customer service people are in America.
Maybe in Rich's neighborhood more so than mine.
Right. All right.
Yeah, that was special.
Let's roll on. We've got three awesome pieces today for you. The first one comes to us from the Young Yet Wise with Candace Marie blog, inspiring millennials to take their money seriously. This piece is four powerful things that happen when you track your net worth. And Paula, you know what? When you track your net worth, according to Candace Marie, lots of great stuff happens.
Yes. According to this author, tracking your net worth allows you to be more intentional or be more mindful about the way that you spend your money. It allows you to have some accountability. It allows you to really get specific about your focus, is point number three that she makes, which I don't totally understand how that's different from point number one, which is being intentional, but whatever. And then point number four is just that you spend more time with the numbers. Actually, I think these all just kind of boil down to like one basic point, which is if you track your net worth, you have a snapshot of where you are at this point in time. And that allows you to move from point A to point B because you know where point A is.
Do you buy it?
Yeah, absolutely. I track my net worth twice a year, once in like January-ish and once in summer-ish.
Greg, I kind of agree. There's probably 2 points, not four in here. But this wider idea of tracking your net worth, I remember having clients that hadn't looked at how much debt they had, and they came in and we put it in front of them, and they're thinking I'm the dentist and it's going to be this horrible thing. And once they got the numbers in front of them, life got a lot better. Like, it's like they took off the blindfold and sat down, and all of a sudden they had the power to do whatever they wanted.
I'm surprised. I thought that story was going to end with them going in the other direction.
Oh, no, they actually did very well. Like, once they looked at the numbers, they felt so much better.
I guess if you're the kind of person who's going to hire a financial advisor in the first place, you're probably better off than you think you are. I mean, I track my net worth out of necessity, not fear. If I want to look at a new investment, whether it's real estate or marketable security or whatever, I think it's obvious that I need to know what condition I will be in if the entire thing goes to hell and takes that portion of my net worth with it. To me, knowing your net worth is as fundamental as knowing your resting heart rate or your blood type or your address and phone number. I mean, granted, your net worth is the only one of those that will change significantly, but still.
I love that. So you're looking at it from a risk management perspective.
Absolutely. I have to, I'm a little more obsessive than most, but then again, I'm doing better financially than most. And maybe the two are intertwined. I can't imagine that there are people who don't take the job of looking at their net worth seriously and make good financial decisions. Maybe there are, I just don't know them.
But sticking with you for a second, Greg, on that point about you're a little more obsessive, I think it's what Candace Marie is saying, is if you keep these numbers in front of you more often, you're more likely to have your subconscious mind working on this stuff more often. That's got to be a big part of your success.
I have my subconscious mind working on it, and I have my fully conscious mind working on it too. It's something to take an interest in. And seeing as I don't have a real 9-to-5 job now, I've got more time to focus on what others might call minutiae like that.
Yeah. Rich, you were telling us a story last week about how during your 20s, you thought you could save later. But then during your 30s, you said, okay, it's time for me to start saving. Did you also not track your net worth in your 20s and then start in your 30s?
You know what? I intermittently used Mint. And even today, I still have an active account there. And I would go in there and looking at my net worth became a depressing exercise in futility for a while. And so when I want to feel good, I go look at my credit score and I'm like, yeah, I'm doing it credit wise. I'm being responsible. But the net worth, even today, I look at it periodically, but it's not something that I've thought about as much. And even a few months ago, I got to a point where I was able to pay off all my personal credit card debt. And I was more focused on the debt number than I was what the net worth number was. And now that that personal debt is gone, now, interestingly enough, I think a lot more about the net worth because that number is a positive number, which makes me feel good. That's just like the credit score does.
Yeah, but that's interesting. You're looking at like a graduation thing. Like you're graduating from going, yeah, my credit score used to be important. It's not as important now. And now my net worth wasn't important. And now that's starting to shine.
Yeah. But I had to get on the other side and see it in positive. I mean, just going in consistently seeing negative, that doesn't work as a motivation tool for me. So I just wanted to see, here's the debt I need to tackle. And then I want to go from there. And that's like some people think in 5, 10-year, 20-year plans, which is important, but I like to just think about the next 12 months. There's already enough going on in life. So I'm thinking, what can I do in the next 12 months to eliminate this debt? And now I'm thinking, what can I do to grow my net worth, grow my savings, whether it's 401k, whether it's my checking or savings account that's generating very poor interest. And so, yeah, it has changed, but I had to go from seeing the negative to knowing I would look in and see something encouraging. I didn't find something red saying you're worth a negative number encouraging. Some people get motivated by that though.
Yeah, because that's what I'm thinking. I'm not thinking that, you know, I'm just thinking that's a starting point. I don't think it's a negative thing. That has as much to do with mindset as anything, don't you think?
Yeah. And this is something that just comes with experience and just even thinking about how my thoughts on money have evolved over the years and the way that I look at budgeting now and how I'm a lot more, okay, I'm going to have this expense in 2-3 years. And I think about that a lot more than I did in my 20s, where I was also like, I can delay on contributing to my 401k now, where I'm like, crap, I'm in my 30s. The number that I need to put away is getting larger and it feels increasingly painful in the present, even though it's something that won't impact me for years out. So even now, I don't really see it as a motivation tool as much as I see it as kind of a check on where I am overall.
Paula, it's funny. Rich talks about, you know, being more obsessed with his credit score. I can't imagine that you look at your credit score at all anymore. Do you?
I do. I check my credit score periodically. I have a credit card that gives me access to my FICO score. So anytime I log into my credit card account, I end up seeing it. But even if I didn't, I'd still keep tabs on that number. I mean, that's just information that's good to know. It's kind of like knowing your weight.
And it's interesting with the credit score because growing up, I thought that was a much more important number. And now that I'm at a point where I'm like, okay, I don't have any big purchases coming up. I'm not looking to buy a house anytime soon. I'm not getting another car. I'm not refinancing anything. The score continues to go up, but I think about it less and I feel less compelled to check it. Whereas for whatever reason in my 20s, I looked at it monthly. I don't know why I was so obsessed with it. I guess because it was a decent number compared to my net worth. Whereas now I may look at it every few months because I know that there aren't things that are at risk. I know I'm not going to get to the point of being late on something. So I just think about it a lot less now.
Yeah. Greg, do you look at your credit score much?
I look at it probably twice a year. It's pretty high. It's been higher in the past. But the thing that I like about having a high credit score is that it enables you to make larger loans, larger business loans at a better rate. So there's certainly a correlation there between how close that score is to 800 and how much it can facilitate future wealth.
I want to ask about some of the points on here, being intentional about your money goals. It seems, Paula, that having those numbers right in front of you really makes it easy to be intentional about what your next move is because you're seeing line item by line item.
Yeah, well, I think it's feedback. Anytime that you are in a situation in which you can actively get feedback about the progress that you're making or about the actions that you're taking, that feedback motivates you psychologically, but it also kind of, I don't know, informs you. Like, you know, you'll see what what steps am I taking that are actually making a difference, and what am I doing that's just noise? And yeah, that's true whether you're, again, to go back to the exercise analogy, the exercise and weight analogy, like getting some type of feedback is helpful regardless of whether your goal is to lose weight, to build muscle, to grow your net worth. You've got to have, not you have to have, but external barometers can really help keep you on that path.
And speaking of external barometers, number two, Rich, on here of her points are having accountability partners. Do you find that helpful, or are you more self-motivated?
I'm more self-motivated, but interestingly enough, I feel like from doing the podcast, it's made me more responsible in some ways. I guess it makes sense. If you're going to be talking about a topic, of course, you want to make sure that you're taking the right steps, but also being realistic that you make mistakes just like anyone else. I've done accountability partners, mastermind groups for business things, but I've never done that for finances. And actually, most people I know are pretty secretive and don't really want to talk too much about money at that level, even if it's just reporting back on how they're doing. I remember a few years ago, I was like, oh, I want to assemble a group of people and we're going to do this. And it was surprisingly difficult to get people together who would be comfortable talking about money on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, it's interesting, Rich. You may not know this, but Greg has a huge mastermind group with a bunch of debt bloggers, and he encourages them to go out and talk about their debt situation once a week, at least, Greg, don't you?
Yeah, I'm sure Rich would love to know all about that. But to your point, and if I can be serious for a second, I couldn't have done this, which is to say, held my financial future in my hands anytime in the mid-1990s or earlier, mostly because I'm too lazy. But knowing now that my financial data is a couple of keystrokes away, that I can wake up in the morning, fix breakfast, and look into my brokerage account and know my balance to the penny without having to wait for them to mail me a monthly statement or bother somebody in the customer service department, that's a godsend. That gives me the ability to take action immediately if I choose to or not.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic place for us to leave it. We're going to move on to our second piece, which we've never done this before. This is from Instagram. It's the Money-ish blog, which is a blog where I've spent a fair amount of time lately. I don't know. This blog is quirky enough. Some of the stuff is absolutely moronic and others is out there, but I always find it very fun. And their Instagram, which is We Are Money-ish, if you want to follow them, they have a moneyish.com minimum wage math. And you know what? You know who I thought of immediately when I saw this? I thought of Paula Pant. Because
really?
Absolutely. Because
I thought you were going to say Greg.
Yes, exactly.
So did I.
Yeah, well, when I saw Snoop Dogg, I thought immediately. But no, Paula, you're always talking about what's your time worth, right? And if 1 hour work is $7.25, all this is, it looks like a receipt. 1 hour of work is $7.25, 40 hours of work, $290. 4 weeks of work, $1,160, gives you $15,000 a year. Then you take the tax out, you're making $12,000 a year. And it says, if you stop at the general math, you're only going to make general math money. I don't know, Paula, is it just me or do you love this?
I like it a lot.
She's like, no, I don't. She's like, no, I don't like it.
The one change that I would make is that 4 weeks of work multiplied by 12 months is 48 weeks. I would have extended that to like, and I realize I'm nitpicking here. I would have extended that to 50 weeks of work per year. And then you can assume 2 weeks of holiday. And the only reason that I say that, I know I'm nitpicking. I know that that's like, I'm missing the broader picture.
That's, you know, way missing the broader picture.
It's just that when you go through a lot of numbers, I don't know, it's important to really have everything on the table as to here's exactly what the assumptions that we're using within this calculation are. Anyway, but I know that that's not the point, and the general point is much more important than that. So I'm going to stop talking now.
Well, good, because I was going to ask Greg. You know, it's funny, this idea of people hear a number, right? $7.25 an hour. Sounds like a decent wage. You do that math, it doesn't go anywhere. You have to find things that are going to pay you significantly more money, and it involves a little bit heavier math than this.
Yeah, the general math line is a quote from Snoop Dogg from an interview with Maria Bartiromo from however many years ago. But again, the exception, Snoop Dogg is one of the few people who can make money off his own unique talent or personality with a scalable model that most of us can't do. Now, as for me, and I always take financial advice from a guy who's two major contributions to society are adding Izzle to every noun and smoking copious amounts of marijuana. What we haven't addressed yet is
he sponsors a football team. He does sponsor a football team.
Then there's that. Yeah, his kid plays here in Las Vegas, Bishop Gorman. Nobody who makes $15,000 a year pays a marginal tax rate of 15%. Whoever came up with this adorable little meme doesn't understand the concept of basic personal deductions, but it did get a couple dozen likes on Instagram, so it must be of value.
Yeah, I didn't even do the math, guys. It's so funny. Paul and Greg immediately do the math. I'm just seeing the big picture that this top line, Rich, of 725 to me is the problem.
Yeah, that gave me heartburn seeing that. In terms of loving this, I am on the side of loving it and thinking great. I mean, even in terms of where I am now, you know, I'm not in a position where I'm scraping or struggling to get by, but I know there are certain things that I want out of life and it's going to take a greater amount of money or some other, or me finding ways to save money in order to achieve those things. So if you're thinking with, you know, as Stu pretty much says here, a minimal, this is all that I need mindset, then you're going to find yourself in a situation where you're thinking about smaller money as opposed to thinking about how you can grow or do more based off of what you make today. But, you know, even thinking about what you can do outside of your day job, whatever that may be, something that may not be as burdensome that allows you to make some extra cash. So I always have the mindset of how can I generate more versus what is the minimum, you know, what's the minimum I have to do to generate this minimum amount of money.
Paula, when you're looking at that first line of how much money you're going to make on a deal, do you look for an acceptable number? Like this 725 isn't going to cut it for Paula Pant. Do you have a set number in mind, or how do you evaluate math-wise what the opportunity is going to be?
Well, are you referring to like an investment deal such as a rental property, or do you mean like if I'm taking on certain work, like with a client?
Absolutely. I'm talking about use of your time. Absolutely.
Use of my time. Yeah, I think I do pay more attention to the gross number than the net because that's the ceiling. And so that's where I start from. And if the gross isn't good enough, then there's no point in even exploring anything further.
But what's good enough for you? I mean, and I'm not going to ask you for the number, but does the number keep going up over time? Or are you looking at what it costs you to get the job done? Are you looking at how are you evaluating your worth?
You know, it's a combination of factors. It's time, it's mental energy. So some tasks are more just cognitively complex and draining than others. So like how much of my energy is this going to drain? How soon does it need to be done? How much do I enjoy it? What kind of like meaning or purpose does it serve? Is this something that I would do for free or for a reduced rate because I believe in it? Or is it just something that I'm doing for the paycheck? Which is not to say, I mean, I would totally do things for the paycheck if the paycheck was high enough. But, you know, something that I think is meaningful is going to get evaluated differently than something that I'm just doing for the money.
But when you say just for the money, you mean it's going to be meaningful and the money that's not meaningful and free.
Whew. You know, I don't think that I can say that every shred of work I've ever done has been meaningful. There's definitely stuff that I've just done for the money. Yeah. So there we are. I mean, nothing has been against my like moral code, but there's definitely stuff that's just, you know, hashtag not my legacy.
You know, it's funny, Greg, and I agree that the math is wrong here because even though there's the 10% bracket, 15% bracket, they do that math correctly. The second step of math, though, is that that gets taken out with deductions, personal exemptions, that type of thing. This still says a little bit about tax shelters, doesn't it? About you can make that tax even smaller. I mean, on this sheet, there's $15,000 and $2,300 or $2,400. Once again, wrong math, but $2,400 is taken away. If I use a tax shelter, I think this very simply shows that I can keep a lot more of my money.
Yeah, but if you're making minimum wage, I think you have more pressing concerns on your mind, like how to become a manager, how to find a better paying job.
Good point. Yeah.
And it is always about math. I mean, last I checked, money was still subject to addition and subtraction like any other quantity you can think of. Now, I measure how much my time is worth. I don't sit down and calculate it, but for most tasks, I can figure out instantly whether it's worth my time or not, but I also understand that I have more than an economic life. I mean, for instance, this afternoon, I drove out into the desert and shot things, and I probably spent about $40 worth of ammunition. I didn't earn any money doing it, but again, yeah, I could have spent those couple of hours sitting at home working, but I opted to do something else. It's called having a balanced life. The last time I actually did sit down and measure the use of my time and how much it's worth, It was when I was contemplating buying a Tesla. And then I realized that if I wanted to make a road trip to, say, Salt Lake City, which I do a few times a year, 440 miles away, every time I do it, I would save $50 in gas. I'd also have to charge my car for 7 hours. And that comes awfully close to $7.25 an hour.
You know, I never saw it when I lived in New York or even lived in Boston, I guess Teslas didn't really exist then. I never saw a Tesla till I came to California, and I went to work one day and I saw him across the parking lot, and I thought to myself, like, oh, these must be like the Hondas of the West Coast. And then I went online and then I looked at the price. Yeah. And then I realized very quickly that I was wrong and that I was in a whole new world of make believe and fairy tales.
Yeah.
I don't know why I added that. It just seemed relevant at the moment.
Yeah, just total fantasy land. I think we'll leave that there. People want to see this. It's just a simple receipt. We'll link to it on our show notes at Stacky Benjamin's. Got to take a quick break from this awesome conversation with Rich, Paula, and Greg to say a big thanks to everybody who is an entrepreneur and has tried out FreshBooks. Because if you're racing against the clock to wrap up three projects, prepping for a meeting later in the afternoon, all while trying to tackle them out in a paperwork, well, guess what? Welcome to life as a freelancer. It's definitely challenging, but our friends at FreshBooks believe that the rewards are so worth it. The working world's changed, and with the growth of the internet, there's never been more opportunities for self-employed people. I was talking to somebody about this last week, about how the job that I do now here didn't exist when I was going to college. Like, there was, I would have had to go into radio to have any hope of podcasting. And you'll see some of the best podcasters out there, the ones that I listen to, you know, they definitely aren't radio people. They're great storytellers, just absolutely fantastic. So I know personally, it's changed a ton. Well, to meet that need, FreshBooks is excited to announce the launch of their all new version, their cloud accounting software, redesigned for the ground up, custom built for exactly the way you work. Get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid quickly. All new FreshBooks, not only ridiculously easy to use, packed full of powerful features. One, you can create and send professional looking invoices in less than 30 seconds. Two, set up online payments with just a couple clicks and get paid up to 4 days faster. And three, see when your client's seen your invoice and put an end to the guessing game. I like that one, especially the fact that I can see when they actually open the email and they saw the invoice. So when they're like, yeah, could you send that again? Stalling. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to Stacky Benjamin's friends. To claim it, here's what you do. StackyBenjamins.com/FreshBooks. That's StackyBenjamins.com/FreshBooks. Enter Stacky Benjamins in the How Did You Hear About Us section. All right, really excited. Here's the way that this went down. I heard about Digit and read a bunch of stuff online. And some of it that really surprised me. Hopefully we'll talk to that. But the great thing about this FreshBooks FinTech segment is I feel very lucky to have friends in lots of corners of that community now. And I reached out to them, and the first three people I reached out to, gracious enough to come on and actually even volunteer to help me find other people. So this hopefully is going to be awesome. And whether you use Digit or not, just thinking about these apps and how young this technology is and how sometimes things change, I think it's a great story. So let's walk over to my dad's shortwave. New article out from Forbes, written by Lauren Gessler on Wednesday. Digit is testing its users' loyalty with a new monthly fee. Big news broke in the financial communities on Tuesday, which is an app that it seems like a lot of people listen to the show use, Digit, that helps people squirrel away savings. What happens is that they have an algorithm, and that algorithm helps people save by deciding how much money they think you're not going to use and automatically moves it over to a savings account. Traditionally, it's been free. They decided that after a 100-day trial, now they're going to $2.99 a month, $2.99, that is, not $299, and they're not adding any new services. And immediately, the internet around me exploded. And so I thought we'd talk about that with three people who have three unique points of view. We have on the shortwave, let's start off in, I believe, in Silicon Valley, where Shane Steele joins us from Chime. Is that where you are?
That's right. Yeah, here in San Francisco.
Nice. Well, welcome to the party. You saw, did your internet blow up yesterday too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We saw a huge amount of activity on Twitter and across all of social media. And, you know, it was an opportunity for us to get involved in the conversation. We certainly, you know, had a point of view on that. I think that, you know, when it comes to financial services, fees are kind of a dirty word and a thing that people really don't like.
Well, which is frustrating, though, Shane, and we'll get back to this later. But you all need to make money, right? I mean, all of us need to make money. Right. So yeah, right. But we'll get into that in a second. Let's introduce the man who helps us tip ourselves in Chicago, Illinois. That's Mike Lentz from the Tip Yourself app. Glad you could make the party.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks, Joe.
And it blew up for you, too, I imagine.
It absolutely did. And I think you're hitting on the right points where when it comes to financial services, fees or just a business model often isn't really just a business model decision. You know, when you're building a savings app or a financial product, your fee structure or charging people money is fundamental to your product. So it really is a big change that Digit made. And I'm sure they did not make this change lightly because it really shifts a lot about what their product is, who their customers is. So yeah. It's very, very interesting to see. And I think they definitely got some attention. That's for sure.
We actually reached out to Ethan Block, the CEO of Digit, about coming on the show. And he wasn't able to come on, so I'm going to try to have you guys give your points of view where we try to figure out what they were thinking and what's going to change for them. But a guy that's actually had a pivot himself, and listeners to the show have heard him several times, it's the very sexy voice of Brad Lawler from the Draft app.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
How are you, man? So you guys actually did a pivot. I mean, this isn't as big a pivot as what you guys did at Draft. Talk a second about that, Brad. What did you guys change?
Yeah, we started off as a consumer product as well, and we made our pivot from B2C to B2B so early in our history that people probably aren't even really familiar with it because we didn't have that much time out in the consumer market. But we came across a similar problem. How do you make money from a consumer product? And we started to see that there were opportunities of making money by charging institutions for our analytics so that when we are ready to deliver a consumer product, we are able to deliver a better product and have more data available to our consumers for our peer comparison tools.
That actually makes sense to me, Brad, because, you know, doing that before the app's even released, making that pivot makes sense. But tons of people, I don't know exactly how many people were using Digit. Shane, you guys have, you know, not the same product, but I guess a similar product at Chime. What do you think was going on in the back room there?
Well, I think, you know, what's already been said that this is about, you know, these companies need to make money. And so you have to have a business model that works and is sustainable. And so it's really just about trying to figure out what's that right value proposition. You know, we're similar in the sense that Chime helps people save automatically. So we have an automatic savings program.
Right.
But we're fundamentally different in the sense that we're a bank account.
Right.
So where we're really innovating is not just around product features, but around the business model. So we have essentially an interchange business. So, you know, people, when they open accounts, set up a direct deposit, we issue a Chime Visa debit card, and we make a portion of the Visa fee on all of those transactions. And so we're actually able to give a portion of those revenues back to our members with our automatic savings program.
Yeah. So what you're saying, Shane, is that in the Chime model, it's already built in. Your income stream is already built in, and now it's about growth.
Right, exactly. I mean, we sort of look at what Digit was doing, which we know have a lot of respect for Digit. They've, you know, created a great product with a great value proposition. But we sort of looked at that as a feature of a bank account, not necessarily a business in and of itself. And I think that this change that's happened this week is a sign that they're looking for the business side of it.
And also, in fairness to Ethan Block, when Forbes talked to him a year ago and they asked him how he was going to make money, he actually said then he had no idea, which is kind of surprising,
that he's
building scale and doesn't know how they're going to make money. But Mike, I look at what you guys are doing at Tip Yourself, and I look at the fact that I use your app. I'm not really sure how you guys make money. Are you guys going to have a similar thing happening in the future?
Well, we have a similar problem we have to solve. So I think Shane hit the nail on the head that in the personal finance space, you know, you need to make sure you're building a sustainable business. So absolutely, like solving the problem of how are we going to build a sustainable business is something Tip Yourself has to approach as well. And I think it comes back to what I said before, which was around what is your product and the customer you're going after. With Tip Yourself, our core vision and what we're trying to do is help people who struggle with money, help them with their habits and financial wellness. And so someone who struggles with money is going to be adverse to fees. And so you know that off the bat. And if that's your target customer, you know, solving the problem, being able to provide a free saving service is something we have to solve at Tip Yourself. And for us, it's going to be about offering other products and services. So we view as savings as the foundation for financial wellness. And for our customer, we're not able to charge a fee by that because it's not right for that customer. But as they grow and they're looking for other products, there's opportunities for us to make money there and in a different product.
You're talking about like a Tip Yourself Plus kind of thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Brad, when you guys made the switch from, and a lot of people listening don't know what B2B and B2C are, but your switch was from business to consumer and instead going after businesses and helping businesses. When you guys made that switch, did you have pressure from your board? Do you think that this was pressure from the board?
It wasn't so much from our early investors or board because they were pretty supportive of either marketing strategy. It was more just because of the huge opportunity that we saw licensing our analytics and tools to financial institutions.
Did you feel like you were giving something away when you made that move, or was it just a clearly no-brainer to go B2B?
Well, you know, when we refer to B2C for consumers and B2B for businesses, we really are referring to our marketing outreach. I mean, ultimately, the end investor is going to benefit from our analytics. It's just a shifting who we're focusing our marketing efforts to and delivering our products and services through, which in this case is now through large financial institutions first, before we start marketing it directly to consumers.
Shane, let's talk about the outcry for a second, because I was one of these people that said, it's three flipping dollars, right? In the big scheme of things, and OG and I have talked about this on Stacking Benjamins a lot, it's not the fee that really is going to stop you from getting where you want to go. I've never heard anybody say, man, if I hadn't blown that $3, I wouldn't have been a millionaire, right? What is it about the fee that really made people go bonkers?
Well, I think you have to look at who their customers are and how much they're actually saving, and does it add up to something that makes sense to them? So I think, you know, people on Reddit were going crazy over this as well and talking about, like, sort of breaking it down by the numbers. And what they were saying there was that you'd have to have about $3,600 every 3 months in order to break even on that $299 a month fee. It sounds like the average Digit customer was saving a lot less than that. I think I saw in some of the personal finance bloggers saying that their readers are saving about $15 a month or so on average. So
I'm actually looking at it right now, Shane, in this Forbes article, I just found it. It says the average user saves between 80 and 170. So you're right. They're way below that.
Right. So it's really just about who are they going after. And if you're able to save $3,600 every 3 months, do you need an app like Digit? And I think that's where some of the outcry happened, because the people who are using it, it's not really going to add up for them.
Do you mind if I jump in and make a silly analogy?
No, take it away.
These groups have to make money. And I kind of compare what Digit is doing to like a personal trainer, that if you went in and the personal trainer said, I'll do this for free, then you'd kind of be like, what's going on here? They're making money off of this. They're not doing it for free, for charity. They're either recording your workout session and making money from somebody online that's watching it, or they're, while you're doing push-ups, they're going through your wallet, taking some money out to make it worth it for them. That's kind of how things work with investment money. Some people don't realize that they're paying for things. It appears to be free, but they're paying for the underlying investment products or accounts, or their data is being sold to other companies.
And it's interesting you say that, Mike, because in this article, Ethan Block says specifically that they thought about selling users' data as a way to make money, said they didn't want to do that. It sounds like they looked at a lot of different ways. Do you think, Shane, back to you, because you guys have such a similar offering, and like you said, it's similar but not the same. You guys have a lot of different stuff that Digit doesn't provide. Do you think they were kind of backed into a corner and this was the only move they could make?
I mean, it's a great question. I think it'll be interesting to see if there is that sense that, you know, people will value a service more because they pay more for it. There's lots of psychology studies that have shown that that's true. When people pay more for something, they value it more. But I think that this is a different category. I think in financial services, there's a huge aversion to fees.
You're kind of saying that a plus model then is what you're saying, I think, Shane, is that a plus model might have been a better option.
Yeah. Or again, like what I was saying, I feel like what Digit has is a nice feature of another, you know, kind of business. It's, you know, a feature of a bank account. And, you know, automation is definitely the way to go. This, you know, it's not necessarily a new concept. You know, personal finance experts have talked for years about how automating your finances is the best way to go, because people are just, you know, not wired well for money. And so automation is a great way to help you get out of your own way. And so Digit really tapped into, you know, an effective tool to help people save when they might have had trouble before. You know, the question is, how do you plug that into the whole picture of somebody's financial life? That's what we're trying to do.
Right. Right. Brad, you guys have an app that looks at performance versus other people's performance, also looks at fees. You were a financial advisor before diving into the fintech space. Do you think this changes the game for Digit?
No, I mean, I think this is a smart move. I think that ultimately people will respect the transparency and understanding of what the fees are instead of hiding them, which is what's happened in financial services and investment industry for so long. You know, the $300 for bank accounts is one thing. One of the things Draft does is to help people understand the massive fees that they're paying for the investment accounts.
Right.
And an underlying investment product. So if Digit is, which I believe they are, is actually helping them save and invest that money, you know, $299, $35 a year, that's nothing compared to what people are actually paying to invest their money today. They just don't know it because they can't Right. see it. One of our early users, a buddy of mine, I told him, you need to pay more attention to your investment fees because these fees really add up over time. And he said, fees only add up if you add them up. And he was fine not knowing about it. But as soon as you tell him it's going to be $2.99 a month, everybody freaks out. But when you compare it to other options, I think it's actually a very fair fee.
Well, I think so. But I also kind of agree with Shane that, you know, if somebody's saving $80 and three of it, you know, is a fee, percentage-wise, Brad, that's a hell of a fee.
It is. I think it comes back to fit. They're going to find their target audience by doing this.
Right. It's going to change. I totally agree. Mike, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was. I think it comes into that fit, exactly what Brad was saying. And the big change that Digit made was they went from a free product to a product that has a fee. So whether it's $1, $2, $3, the biggest jump there is to go from free to we have a fee.
Right.
So that's the big change. And I think that's going to shift their target customer. And it changes their product pretty drastic. And I think that's a lot of the outrage we saw. You know, there's obviously a little bit of that gut, like, oh my God, they're charging us a fee. But when you look past it, a lot of people looked genuinely bummed out. They're like, hey, I used to use this product for a little bit of, you know, fun savings here and there. And now that it involves a fee, I can't use that product for that purpose. So I think you're seeing a lot of people that used to use a product find out that that product's changed. And of course, you know, people are going to be emotional about it. So, you know, Digit's made a bold decision to kind of focus their product on something very specific. They now have a very clear business model. They're going to charge fees, and it's going to be interesting to watch.
They actually won a customer and me because of this press. I didn't know much about them before because I run a startup that's in the middle of a pivot, so there's not a lot of money to save. But as soon as there is, this press brought to my attention what they were doing, and I think that I do associate value in what they're doing with their technology. And I also notice that they are raising their interest rates from, you know, 20 basis points to 1%, which is nice. And I probably do fit more in that realm of target customer that this makes more sense for.
That's interesting. I didn't think about people swimming the other way. Unfortunately, guys, I got to leave it there. But Shane, let's start with you guys. You guys have the 1% at Chime. Tell us, you told us a little bit briefly about Chime, but tell us where people can get more information.
Yep, you can go to chimebank.com. And so we're a bank account that offers a savings account with no monthly fees, no minimums, no overdraft. We issue a Visa debit card. And then, as I was saying before, like one of the features that people love the most about it is we have an automatic savings program that uses roundups. So every time you use your Chime card to pay a bill or make a purchase, we round up the transaction to the nearest dollar, transfer it into your savings account. And then every Friday, we pay out a 10% bonus on the roundups for that week. And so let's say you're using your card twice a day on average, you'll have $400 in your savings account at the end of the year without even having to think about it. So it's really a nice way to help people get started on a healthy habit towards savings, which we know is a big, big challenge in this country because most Americans don't have $500 in savings.
Right, which is very sad. We've reported on that before. Mike, at Tip Yourself, I tip myself all the time. I go on a run, I tip myself. It's a super easy app to use, but tell everybody about Tip Yourself.
Yeah, right, Joe. I mean, you tip everyone else, right? So why don't you tip yourself? Our product is very different. We have a very different approach to personal finance. Unlike a lot of products that are focused on money, charts, numbers, and graphs, with Tip Yourself, we recognize that the real problem for millions of people is much more emotional. It's much more about our mindset, our habits. And with Tip Yourself, we want to go after that, help you feel good about money, help you get started on building a healthy habit. Because You know, we have never met anybody that struggles to save money because they just haven't found the right spreadsheet yet. Right. It's much more about how you feel about money. And so, yeah, that's what Tip Yourself is. Nice, fun, easy to use tool. Push a button, reward yourself, tip yourself. You earned it.
I've talked extensively with Shane and Mike about their cool fintech stuff. I think that's the technical term for you guys, cool fintech stuff. Mm-hmm. That's what you call it around the office. I'll also link to both of those extended interviews in our show notes at stackybenjamins.com. But Brad, I'm most curious because you and I haven't talked. I've spoken with Shane lately, spoken with Mike a little bit lately. Brad, haven't talked to you, I feel like, in 4 or 5 months. What's going on over there at the Draft app?
We are taking our platform, our analytics platform, which helps to understand holistic investment portfolios, regardless of where those assets are held. And we're helping financial institutions better understand their customers and their prospects' holistic portfolios so that they can provide better advice and better holistic advice. These firms are applying our technology to hundreds of thousands of accounts and portfolios at a time to be able to provide better services. And we are using that data, anonymizing it, and we will be releasing a consumer tool probably toward the end of the year that helps individual investors, whether they're working with an advisor or do-it-yourself investors, better understand their risk, their equity diversification, their fees, their historical performance, all versus their peers with similar risk tolerances, instead of comparing it to like the S&P 500, so that they can really understand if they're paying too much in fees, if they're taking too much risk, so that they can make better decisions. And to sign up for that and get on later in the year, that is draftapp.com.
Awesome. And I'll link to that also. And a couple of the discussions you and I have had in the past, Brad, on our show notes at stackybenjamins.com. Shane, Mike, Brad, thanks for hanging out and trying to help me figure out what the heck's going on over at Digit.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Big thanks again to Shane, Brad, and Mike for helping us. By the way, for more on their awesome fintech tools, head to stackybenjamins.com and click on today's show notes page and you'll get more from them. All right, let's get back to our awesome discussion with special guests, Rich Jones from Paychecks and Balances, Mr. Crazy Man, Greg McFarland from Control Your Cash, and Paula Pant from Afford Anything. All right, guys, we did this last week. We're going to do it again today. Going to go back to the moneyologist again. Here's what happens for those of you that are new to the show. The moneyologist is a column at MarketWatch, and Quentin Fortrell is asked questions by readers, supposedly, according to Mr. McFarland here. He's asked questions, and they're always exotic and a little bit weird, and I don't really care what the moneyologist said. I like posing these questions to our panel. So I'll link to the actual question and answer in our show notes, but let's see what you three can do with this one. It says, dear moneyologist, one financial accomplishment my spouse and I are proud of is helping both our two kids finish college without any loans. They both work hard to get substantial scholarships and worked while attending school. Fast forward 10 years, and in having the family, quote, talk about finances as we age, we're retired in our mid-60s, we let them know we have plenty of money and we'll never spend it all. We're absolutely sure. Neither kid's ever asked for a dime, but they've been given generous gifts over the years. We've asked them if there's anything that would help them at this time instead of waiting for an inheritance. Turns out one of our children has substantial loans not related to student debt in an iffy profession, not always working and not always paid well despite his best efforts at loan repayment. He'd like our help. Our other kid, not in need of funds, is fine with this. We agreed to begin paying off the loans and have now paid off two smaller ones totaling $25,000. Now my spouse is backing off, regretting, quote, telling them about our financial situation and offering to pay loans. Despite several recent discussions, nothing has changed. One more thing, my health is compromised, and this is something I'd like to do before I'm too ill. I could simply take my own funds and pay off the loans around $50,000, but I wondered if you had other thoughts. So Conflicted Father writes this. Greg, we'll start with you, assuming Conflicted Father isn't just Quentin Fortrell's own writing. What does he do? Does he pay him off? His spouse doesn't want him to do that.
Does every moneyologist letter writer have one responsible kid and one deadbeat kid? Or is this just emblematic of the world as a whole?
Maybe
it keeps reminding me of the show This Is Us for some reason, but anyway.
Maybe it's on my mind, Greg, because I have two kids. So maybe I'm just picking those, you know, because they have to do with my life.
substantial loans not related to student debt and an iffy profession. I would love to know what that means. Did he buy salmon eggs on credit in hopes of a lucrative career as a hatchery maven? I want to know. I don't get any of this, and maybe it's because I'm not a parent, but again, why are these people looking for approval? In this case, why do you need the approval of the other kid? Or why are you indulging an indebted kid who, again, is an adult and needs to fix his own mistakes? And if you want to indulge him, fine, but I don't get why this needs to be someone else's business. Moneyologist needs to find some bigger disasters.
But wait a minute, Greg. Let's peel the onion back a little bit. Let's say that you do have a kid and you're fine. At what point do you tell them that you're okay? And maybe it sounds like he wants to watch his kids enjoy some of his money instead of passing away and leaving it to them later. Maybe they could use it more now, right? And he wants to be a part of that. If that's the case, if you have a child, would you tell them early about your money and that, hey, I've got cash. If you ever need anything, come see dad? Or do you let that go?
Yeah, I would think that you have cultivated enough of a relationship with your child over the decades that you can speak frankly about this kind of thing and that you know whether your child is going to be amenable to the idea and appreciative. Maybe they will, maybe they won't, but you should have figured that out before you wrote the letter.
I think I messed up because I have a panel with three people. Rich, you don't have children, do you?
I do not. I do not. But these stories and these questions are making me think about it a lot. Well, one thing I did want to say, so this line, one of our children has substantial loans not related to student debt and an iffy profession. I kind of read that as if the person had read last week's question and said, you know what, my son does not have an iffy position. He wasn't an actor. He wasn't doing something that was shady or sketchy. So you could read that two ways.
Well, and but that's why Greg thinks they're all written by Quentin Fortrell.
Well, there's that.
It's because we've got a very similar plot line here as to the one that we picked last week. But let me ask you the same question I asked Greg. Your health is starting to fail. You've got plenty of money. You want to see, you know, your kids, if they want to enjoy some of the money, do you tell them that you have cash or do you wait until you pass away?
I think they would know through life that I probably had some money unless I suddenly came into it later on. That's one thing.
But do you start distributing it before you pass away or do you wait until you pass away?
No. I think I would wait till I passed away. And I think in this particular scenario, I'm leaning towards saying, okay, I'll take care of this last little bit of debt for you. And then after that, you're on your own. And maybe just saying that. And then if they come back and ask and need something, that's something else. But at least put the expectation there that anytime this son needs money for whatever it is that's going on, don't just come and ask mom and dad. Try to figure it out yourself first.
All right, Paula Pant, the pressure's on. You've got the last word here.
Ooh.
I know.
The last word. My reaction when I read this letter was that the author of this letter wants to give $50,000 to one of the two children. So, and they've got plenty of money. And so for the parent's sake, not so much for the kid's sake, but because it's something that the parent wants to do, sure, do it if that's what makes you happy. And while you're at it, if you've got the funds, which it sounds like you do, in the interest of fairness, give $50,000 to the other kid too. And then, all right, that's $100,000. Based on what they've written, it sounds like they've probably got plenty more. So maybe it's time to have a discussion about what next, you know?
You get $50,000. You get $50,000. You get $50,000.
Everybody gets $50,000. Yeah. So if it's you, do you give it away before you pass away to the kids and watch them enjoy it? Or do you wait until you die?
Oh, gee. I mean, that's such a hypothetical. I don't think that I have the life experience to be able to know what my future self would do, since I would be a different person at that time.
Oh, that's such a cop-out answer. Come on.
I don't think anyone wants to see their kids struggle.
Spending the money in front of them should give them incentive.
I mean, so on the other hand, I'm very much a believer in, like, if you teach people to be independent as quickly as possible, and the more you enable somebody, the less you facilitate that independence.
So taking them out for ice cream, to Greg's point, and you buy your own and eat it right in front of them, right in their face, Greg?
Well, with me, it was more like, your mother and I are going to Bora Bora. See you in 3 weeks.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah.
There's also another perspective to this too, though. So paying off that $50,000 in loans for that one son will allow them to get their financial footing together to go and pursue that thing that they've wanted to do for so long that's going to put them in a better position financially down the road. Maybe that alleviates some of the stress and burden of thinking about how they're going to pay off the debt so they can actually focus on whatever the heck it is they want to do with their life.
You hope that, but when it's money from your parents, does that, Paula, do you think that seems like a little easy money? You know what I mean? Like, oh, okay, well, that money came from mom and dad, so it's not as motivational as if I earned it.
Yeah, I think it can facilitate a sense of entitlement. And entitlement is the opposite of responsibility. I think generally, and I'm not a parent, but I do think that the best approach is to encourage radical self-responsibility and independence as quickly and as effectively as possible.
You know, we've got, speaking of not being a parent, we've got one more thing we got to talk about, Paula. Our good mutual friend, Steve Stewart, Steve, who also engineers both of our podcasts. Steve was on Twitter a couple weeks ago talking about how it looks like, only longtime listeners will get this, but it looks like the princess is pregnant. Is that true?
He tweeted that and he posted it on Facebook and all of that. I checked, so much of a dork I am. I checked the Twitter feed for Clarence House, which is like the PR house of the Royal Palace. And no, they have not confirmed anything. So that's just tabloid rumor. You can ignore it. We'll wait for confirmation from the palace.
Rich has no idea what the hell we're talking about, but that's very important to long-term listeners that the eight ball might have been right. But I think that's a good note to end it on. So let's talk about what's going on where you work. Greg, I've got one question for you, man. Why the heck are there people listening to this that haven't read Control Your Cash, the most phenomenal Amazon purchase they could possibly make?
I don't know why. I don't know what they're waiting for. It is available. I've joined the 21st century, and it is no longer available in softcover format. Only the Kindle version. If you don't have a Kindle, what are you waiting for? And you can download it at Amazon.com for just $7. Because there are no more softcover versions being made, scarcity, and the market is such, you can buy a softcover version on Amazon for some ungodly amount of money. Let's see what it is. It's up there in the three digits. Yeah, you can buy a used version for $455.
But it's a collector's edition then, Greg.
And those are ones I haven't even signed.
Imagine, add a signature to that baby. What happens then? We'll have a link as usual to the book and our show notes at Stacking Benjamins. Rich, thanks a ton for playing 2 weeks in a row, man. You are a glutton for punishment, pal.
Yeah, I swam back into the mix. And this week on the podcast, we're talking to Kirk Chisholm about renting versus buying. It's been a real popular discussion topic amongst our listeners lately. And then also back to budget and basics and this idea of the backdoor reference. And we might actually end up doing a follow-up to the 500K struggle episode that I mentioned last week. So a lot going on and a lot more good stuff planned over the next few months. I just hope we can stay ahead.
I still think that's crazy listening to that episode. $500,000 and you're having trouble making ends meet.
You know, I went into work and mentioned this, and this actually became a conversation in a meeting where there were people who were trying to justify it and there are people who were saying it's crazy. It's a really contentious issue. And since doing that episode, I've had conversations with people and they've actually been able to make some sense of the numbers. Now, I still believe that there's a lot one can do to put themselves in a better position financially, not factoring in all the lifestyle inflation stuff. But if you're moving on up and there's certain things you're doing, there's going to be more expenses, but struggling. I could not see me, this guy, struggling with 500K with Boobookins and our two kids and our dog Mello. I just don't see that struggle happening. And if I did get to a point where we're making 500K and we're struggling, we're moving. We are going to a different state, different city, that obscure town I referenced. No offense, Joe. We're probably going to make some changes in our life.
You could be my neighbor. That'd be fun.
Yeah. I got to come down, check it out. And I want to explore the basement some more. I hear you got some interesting artwork down there.
We will hang out in the basement. It's some people call it scary, but we'll stay away from that. And here's what's funny. At this point, we'd say goodbye to Paula Pant, but Paula, we lost Paula. Guys, thanks for playing.
Thank you.
See you later.
Oh, that's going to do it for today, kids. Guess what? We are playing a game, and we only have one more week. after this week of the game, unless somebody answers it today. And I think we've given you enough clues that we should get some answers. In fact, it's funny. We have actually had an answer. Our friend Dan, who has won previously, answered. He actually guessed it 2 weeks ago. And nobody else has gotten it except Dan, which doesn't surprise me because Dan's Johnny on the spot. In fact, there have been other times that Dan has said, yeah, I know I'm not eligible to win, but here's the answer to your game. I find Dan incredibly annoying that he guesses my games so quick. Actually, I wish I had a brain like that. Hey, but before we get to the game, I'm going to talk more about that. Also going to tell you what's coming up next week and also a little bit more about what's going on in the basement. I have to remind you first that if you're looking for help with your personal loans or your student loans, StackyBenjamins.com/SOFI is the place to go. That's StackyBenjamins.com/SOFI. When you point your browser there, it's going to ask you which of those you're looking for. And from that point, you're going to fill in a few details about you. And our friend Dan Macklin over at SOFI says in a few seconds, in most cases, you're going to know everything about how they can work with you. You're going to know the terms, which, by the way, there's a ton of. You're going to know the interest rates, which you'll be surprised at how low they are. And you'll also know how easy the paperwork is because our friends at Magnify Money list their fine print rating as A+. What I like mostly about SoFi is after you start working with them, now you're a member. You're not a customer that once they get you to sign on the dot, you ever feel like that? You sign on the dotted line and then, yeah, okay, we've got you and we're not talking to you anymore. SoFi is not that company. They'll help you find a new job. We had Steve Gashy on from SoFi talking about that. That's his job, is helping SoFi members with their careers. How cool is that? They've got a fantastic blog. They have events around the United States specifically for members to network and get to know other professionals in their area. I'll tell you, SoFi is a different type of company. StackyBenjamins.com/SoFi. They'll throw in $100 if you use our link for your student loan refinance or your next personal loan. And while you're saving money, head to StackyBenjamins.com/MagnifyMoney because the average person who goes here saves $450, $550 altogether. Add those up, plus the money you save in interest rates, whether it's higher interest rates on a checking or a savings account, or it's lower interest rate on any of the debt that you have. You'll see there that SoFi is rated number one wherever they compete, but there's a lot of places where they don't. So if you're looking to rework your entire financial picture to things that actually make sense, you know, we shop for gasoline, we shop for jeans, we shop for whatever it might be. We don't shop the financial products. We just head down to the bank and take what they have. In fact, our friend Erin Lowry, who is going to be on the show next Friday, and also she's going to, well, I can't tell you that. Getting ahead of myself here. Erin talks about how when she talks to millennials about how they always seem to have the same bank accounts as their parents do, and it's costing them a lot of money. StackyBenjamins.com/MagnifyMoney if you want to get the right things for you. All right, let's talk about next week. By the way, next week is our last week of this 8-week period. For those of you new to the show, what happens is we used to just do 3 times a week. And we found that podcasts started coming out a little late. We started having some mistakes. The scripts weren't written as well as they were. You know what? You just get fatigued. So we take 1 week off every 8 weeks and we recharge the batteries. We clean up the basement. We make sure that we've got the best guests that we can have on the show. And the shows are crisp as they can be for this type of a podcast. So that's what we're doing. The Fintern comes down in 2 weeks. We call him the Fintern, but his name is Griffin the Intern. And Griffin comes down and plays some of our greatest hits from the past. So if you are new to the show, you're going to hear some of our best episodes from the past, I think 5 years overall of podcasting. It's been a wild run. But before that, let's talk about next week. You know, here's something that doesn't happen very much. What if you wrote a book and it wasn't a New York Times bestseller, but so many people liked it and so many people read it that it became a New York Times bestseller 8 weeks after it was out? That's what happened with Jen Sincero when she wrote the book, You Are a Badass, totally transforming the way that you think about yourself. Well, she has her follow-up book, You Are a Badass at Making Money. And when I saw this, that this was coming, I immediately reached out to Jen and her team, and they agreed that she would come down to the basement and talk to us. So that's Monday. We're going to turn you into Badass with Money. Then on Wednesday, I don't say these next words lightly. This is the best book I've seen on finding a job and keeping a job. And of course, that's because it's written by the founders of themuse.com, my favorite website for careers, not just finding a career, but holding on to a career and being better at your job. Catherine Minshew and Alex Kavakalis, the founders of themuse.com, are coming down to the basement to talk about the new rules of work. And definitely things have changed. So whether you've been in the workforce for a long time or you're just headed out, I like this book for me. I also like it for my kids. I've bought copies for both Autumn and Nick immediately after I received, you know, when we do these interviews, they send you a not yet dressed up copy because the book's not out yet. It's a really ugly copy just so I can read through it and get organized and make sure that we have the best interview ever. Hopefully they sent me that. I immediately pre-ordered two of them. We'll talk a little bit about the book. We're just going to share as many lessons from the book of the read. All right. I think that's going to do it. Thank you very much. If you've referred friends to us, I read online. People telling their friends about us on social media channels. That's so gratifying. Thank you. If you've left us a review of the show, wherever you listen, that also helps us find new listeners. I love your emails. You guys make me laugh. I love sharing some of the jokes and stories. And for me, that's really what this is all about. It makes this, frankly, the most fun, quote, job I've ever had. So on behalf of our whole team here at Stacky Benjamins, thanks a ton. All right. Have yourself a fantastic weekend. Remember that webinar on Thursday. If you have anything to do with student loans, you want to know when not to refinance, Amanda Wood's going to be with us noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, stackybenjamins.com/webinar to sign up. All right. We'll see you then. Go stack some Benjamins.
Special thanks to Rich Jones from Paychecks and Balances for stopping by. You'll find a link to his podcast in our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. Thanks also to Shane Steele from Chime, Mike Lentz from Tip Yourself, and Brad Lawler from The Draft App for joining us to talk about Digit. You'll find links to all of these fintech tools on our show notes page at stackingbenjamins.com. Paula Pant appears courtesy from affordanything.com. And Greg McFarlane comes to us from his palace at controlyourcash.com. This show is the property of SB Podcasts, LLC. The show is created by Joe Salcihi, produced by Richie Rutter-Reese, and engineered by me, Steve Stewart. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remuneration. Joe's mom says it's important for me to remind you that you shouldn't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and before making any financial moves, consult with a real financial advisor. And this is Steve Stewart sitting in for Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. If you're lucky, I'll be back here again next week instead of that ass. But as we all know, Joe's mom's a softie and continues to let Doug back into the house. It's unbelievable. But I had a wonderful time with you this week. Come back Monday when we talk to Jen Sincero, New York Times bestselling author of You're a Badass at Making Money. See ya. Yeah, nailed it. That's a wrap.